Quiet. Come on. No, shut up. It's going to start. Shut up.
Barack Obama is about to make a speech.
That's right, it's speech time, baby. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is In the Loop. By the time many of you hear this, the great Cairo Muslim Reconciliation Oration of 2009 will no doubt be cast already in legend. We'll all be talking about where we were when it happened, that kind of thing. But looking at it from this moment, the day before, it feels kind of dated somehow. It's a leftover campaign idea. And back when he was Mr. Speech Guy and it was all fresh and new, I'm sure it was like, you know what would be awesome, everybody, for dealing with this whole Muslim hatred, terrorism thing? Like, gather around, listen to this. Seriously, we should do a speech. But now, you know, 6 months later, it feels kind of like, hey, a speech. Ooh, let me set my TiVo. I think maybe where Barack Obama's speeches jumped the shark was a couple weeks ago with some national address on cybersecurity. Does anybody else remember this? And if you don't, that maybe that's part of the point. I mean, I don't doubt that cybersecurity is important, and I'm sure it's important. But, you know, until or unless Osama bin Laden himself has somehow hacked the mainframe or whatever, it's just not worth the drum roll. Just do it. I don't need a speech on that. Anyway, big Muslim speech. I'm sure it'll be game-changing. And maybe, you know, hearing from the president so frequently is just a shock to the system after the previous 8 years. But I do think we're probably good on the major presidential addresses for a while now. By the way, shout out to Lacey Joy Olson, fan number 900 on our Facebook page. Just signed up today, as a matter of fact. We hit that 900 mark. Lacey Joy, or Lacey. I think it's funny on Facebook, a lot of people have their middle names in there to distinguish that, but it's never clear whether they use them or not. Anyway, Lacey Joy Olson, thanks very much for joining us on the Facebook page, loopfacebook.net. If you're not there already, sign up. We roll out a lot of content there and ask a lot of questions there as well. Among the questions we asked the other day, and let's get right into it. Let's not save the good stuff for later in the podcast. Let's get right into it. We asked, anybody have any good ideas for parody songs about North Korea? Because I was sort of thinking, you know, maybe one will turn up that's interesting, and I'll take it and run with it. Well, we got a whole bunch of them. In fact, so many that I thought, you know, why would we do just one? Why not create some kind of, like, user-generated medley of North Korea-related music? North Korea, of course, with those nuclear tests and all that, and there have been even more tests and provocative actions since we made this suggestion. Very much in the news, and so I took a number of these ideas, seven, I think, including, well, one of mine that I really wanted to do. Wrote up a bunch of lyrics as fast as I could, headed into the studio with a small army of instruments that I just happened to have in my car anyway, because I was playing a gig that weekend. And magic happened, courtesy of you all. So here it is, the user-generated North Korea satire medley.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been building defenses for so long now. Well, you're a loony, and you ain't getting no younger. Your people dying of hunger, eating grass like a cow. Pushed the button again. Tried to be tough. Got a message to send. Oh, baby, no, you're making a fuss. You better believe I'm serious. Or did I lose all my senses? That is just so typically me. Oh, baby, baby, oops, I did it again. I played with my nukes, and I lost all my friends. Oh, baby, baby, oops, what am I in for? Are we headed to war? I just want you to think I'm cool.
All right, now we come to the Broadway show tunes portion of the medley. Thanks to everybody who suggested these. This one, a little more obscure. It's from Carousel.
Kim Jong-il, he's as short and as mad as a bee, is he? Kim Jong-il's got no obvious succession tree. Oh, gee, testing out those nukes, pissing off his friends like he just ain't got nothing to lose. Is he going to play or just fade away? At some point, the guy's got to choose. Quit being so cryptic. At some point, you've just got to choose. Well, how do you solve a problem like Korea? Where do you start when you can't pin them down? Who hugs you tight, then turns and says, I'll see ya? Who changes their tune each time you turn around? They call me Kim Jong-il, a Mr. Kim Jong-il, feeling kinda ill, looking out my windowsill. I got to make you see me, what it's like to be me. Please let me be your friend. Oh, Mr. Cellophane, Mr. Cellophane. Well, you all know my name, but you don't know my pain. You can look right through me, won't listen to me. What's it gonna take?
All right, now turn a little more contemporary. A little.
All I really want is you to like me. All I really want is to fit in. Yeah. You made so many promises, so did I. I've made up my mind. I ain't wasting no more time. Here I go again. Here I go again. Oh yeah. Six party talks just leave me hollow. Never seem to find what I'm looking for. I'm getting old, don't have the strength to carry on. 'Cause I know what it means to walk along the lonely street of dreams. Here I go again on my gonna wear the only clothes I've ever known. Keep my sunglasses on and my hair properly windblown. Oh, 'cause I've made up my mind. I ain't wasting no more time.
Thought I'd have another test since you ignored all the rest. Maybe underground make a giant sound you could hear all across the West. Hey, what could I expect? Maybe gain a little respect. But my Russian friends show me their ear ends. Even China left me hanging, leaving me to doubt if I ever can fit in here. This lonely place I am right now, it seems I've always been here. Everybody turns away. I'll get you all someday. Alone again, naturally. Yes, alone again, naturally.
All right, let's see. We had song ideas in there from Veronica Jacobson, Mark Neymark, Becky Clausen, Grizzly Smith, Chad O'Hazelbaker, and, well, our boy Sandon Totten threw the White Snake idea in there. Just for kicks, I videoed the entire process of recording that thing. It's the first time I'd done that. And I'm hoping to get that put together as soon as we put this here podcast to bed. I thought it might be kind of interesting to show how I put music like that together for the show. So look for that on Facebook and on our regular website, of course. InTheLoopShow.net is a shortcut to get you there. Or .com, InTheLoopShow.net. Or .com. We also had someone submit an entire set of lyrics on Facebook for a North Korea song. And then, at my request, he recorded those lyrics at home and he sent me that file and I whipped it up into something. I'm going to play the result of that a little later in the show. We throw all kinds of questions about the news of the moment or whatever out to Facebook. And the other day I asked whether anybody loves their Chrysler. Because let's face it, in the media and from the government, Chrysler is not getting a lot of love right now. People are very critical. And now you've got GM stealing all the attention by declaring bankruptcy. And we heard from, five, six people saying, yeah, I had a Chrysler and, it was a piece of crap or worst car I ever owned. But within that batch, one brave person said, yeah, I like my Chrysler. And that was Natasha Goblish. Natasha, thanks very much for talking with me.
Yeah, no problem.
And I gather you're walking to your car, or maybe in your car at this moment. Is that your Chrysler?
It's my Jeep, actually.
A Jeep, okay, which is is owned by Chrysler. And which Chrysler cars have you had over the years, and what do you have now?
Our newest one is a Pacifica.
Okay, and remind me, what's a Chrysler Pacifica?
Chrysler Pacifica, it's kind of like a van / station wagon kind of family car.
Okay, and your Jeep is a what?
It is a Cherokee, so it's a little 5-speed, gets pretty good gas mileage and 4-wheel drive, which is nice in the winters around Minnesota.
And you and your family have actually sought out Chryslers, or just work out that way?
Well, my husband for a while worked at a dealership, a Jeep dealership, and, you know, he knew what vehicles ran well. He knew how to fix them and affordable parts.
Is it fair to say that you love your Chrysler cars, or what would be too strong a word?
I would say we probably love them. The past 10 years, we've owned nothing but.
Chrysler's the company that feels just like most on the edge, right? I mean, they're the smallest. If they were to go away completely, maybe it would be the least painful for the economy. A lot of people think, well, this Fiat thing, maybe it'll save them, maybe it won't. But, this just feels like publicly and in the media, whatever, there's not a lot of love lost for Chrysler. Do you get that sense, too?
Not really where I'm from. We're kind of from a smaller town, so I think it's pretty popular over here.
And where are you again?
By Mankato, Minnesota.
Well, that's interesting. Why do you think the vibe is different in a small town?
Probably because more rural people kind of need cars that, you know, trucks, Jeeps, things that they can pull trailers with, more farm work, that sort of thing.
Big Dodge trucks, stuff like that, I suppose, too, huh?
Yep.
Are you thinking about a Chrysler-less future?
That would be really sad to think about, and we'd probably try to find what's out there for a while at least.
Even if the dealerships and the company's going away, you can't get service, all that kind of stuff people would worry about buying a Chrysler, you would still seek one out?
Yes, I would. Pretty comfortable with how they run. Like I mentioned, my husband knows, you know, how they go together.
Do you have to know how to fix one with your own bare hands in order to be able to drive a Chrysler?
He does. I don't.
But it's a useful thing, I guess.
Absolutely.
Would it feel a little different to people in the Mankato area there if really what you're driving is a Fiat?
If they knew about the change, it might, possibly, but there's a lot of foreign cars that are doing really well. There's no choice, I guess.
And are you driving at this very moment now? Have you pulled
out? Yes, I am.
Okay, how's the ride? Is it smooth and the usual?
It's going like it should, yep.
Purring like a Chrysler kitten.
Exactly.
Natasha Goblish lives near Mankato, Minnesota. In what's your particular small town? Might as well name it.
Cortland.
Cortland, in Cortland, Minnesota. Thanks very much for keeping up within the loop and talking back to us on our Chrysler question.
Yep, no problem.
All right, have a safe drive.
Yep, bye.
Bye-bye. Just got a little note here from Natasha, whose husband would like you all to know that his Jeep is sitting at 300,000 miles on it, people, with minimal maintenance. I posted my conversation with Natasha yesterday on our page, and wouldn't you know it, we turned up some more Chrysler fans. Julia says she loves her Jeep, and her daughter cried when they sold their Dodge. Susie says she loves her cars like children, and she'll miss Chrysler when it goes over to the dark side, parentheses, Fiat. Not sure exactly what that means. I didn't know Darth Vader was running things over at Fiat. If so, I'd expect some very interesting models to come out of that partnership. And Bill says the Chrysler Crossfire and Dodge Magnum had great styling and Mercedes hardware, for crying out loud. What is not to like? Thanks, everybody. I'm Jeff Horwich. It's In the Loop. And let's keep going with something sort of along those lines. Lately, we've been deciding, evidently, that certain companies and industries, like the car companies and banks, of course, are too big to fail. I was caught by a provocative op-ed in the Washington Post the other day that suggested we need to also put newspapers into that category. Bruce Brown co-wrote that piece with another partner at his law firm, Baker Hostetler. Bruce is with me from out in D.C. Bruce, thanks for coming on In the Loop.
Great to be here.
And let's just be upfront here. You represent in your practice media companies, a number of newspapers in particular, right?
We do. Newspapers, magazines, traditional broadcast, and even some internet companies as well.
You think that the legal deck is stacked against traditional news media, old-fashioned journalism. What's the problem?
Well, what we try to point out in our piece is that the internet, as wonderful as it's been for the growth of free speech in our country and around the world, is not something, of course, that just grew up overnight. There were laws that Congress carefully thought through to ensure that the internet was able to grow and prosper at a time when it was still a fledgling medium. Well, 10 years or 15 years into the internet revolution, it's clear that while those laws have enabled certain kinds of business models to succeed, there have not been laws that have enabled traditional journalism companies to also prosper online.
We're talking about copyright as a big one here, right? Explain how that how that works.
The internet has made it, because of the new technology, extremely easy for copy to get linked and pasted and spread all throughout the internet. And yet the journalism companies have not had the tools to protect the sweat of their labor that goes into the creation of that content. So what we tried to propose in our piece were a couple of modest ideas of how to amend the copyright law, possibly create some kind of federal statute that would protect the misappropriation of news content, what we call linksploitation. Those would be instances in which companies were essentially put up online in order to just benefit from the hard work that other journalists do by linking to it, and then selling ads around that.
Well, now, that gets to one of the things that's both fascinating and some would say, like, just crazy about what you're talking about, was you're going after the search engines, right, which is what people use to find their way to the Washington Post, New York Times, you name it. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're saying the search engines are getting a free ride by being able to to index what the papers are doing in this case and point people to it.
Right. What I would say is that search engines are obviously incredibly valuable, and in an appropriate balance, a search engine and a traditional news organization can truly help each other reach their business goals. But news organizations really have no choice but to be indexed by those sites, and yet they're not deriving any kind of licensing fee from the search engines or any kind of revenue sharing from the search engines that we think is a fair trade for what the search engines get in return.
But the search engines are still getting people to the newspaper sites. And just because the newspapers can't find a way to turn that revenue online, why is that Google's problem?
You know, I think it's fair to ask whether or not we've come to a point where plainly the advertising dollars are not going to support quality journalism online. Shouldn't the search engines, which derive significant economic benefit, if not all of their economic benefit, from the content that they scoop up online free of charge, be asked to share some of the advertising revenue that they're deriving from that content that would otherwise be advertising revenue that would be going to traditional news organizations.
You're talking about something that you're calling the Journalism Recovery Act is kind of the label you put on it, which is a nice term, easy to remember, and a couple other elements to it that we don't need to dwell on the details of, just to share with people along with the copyright stuff. Changing ownership restrictions and antitrust exemptions so that we could have more media consolidation. These companies can sort of, from a business perspective, protect themselves a little more. Some sort of tax break for news production. This seems to be about government declaring that journalism, like old-fashioned journalism, not blogging, not linking to stuff, not twittering about, you know, the latest news item, but like journalism, reporting, declaring that a societal good.
Right. Well, and Congress has already done that. When Congress passed the Newspaper Preservation Act in 1970, which was its first foray into a limited antitrust immunity for the industry, and in passing that law, Congress said it is in the public interest for a press that is economically viable. And I think the other point I would make is that if we don't intervene to make some reevaluations of where we're going, we may find ourselves with a much diminished internet years from now, some news organizations gone, many other news organizations perhaps behind paywalls. I think if we can't devise some reasonable ways to share revenue between aggregators and traditional news sites, between search engines and traditional news sites, the internet will become much less the place it is today, where there's more sharing of information.
Suppose we can agree, you know, that journalism is valuable, and I suppose most of us probably can. Where do you draw the line, though, where journalism ends and mooching begins?
The measures that we're talking about are not measures that would change the way that the vast majority of bloggers or internet users consume and use and share information. What's hurting the news organizations isn't the occasional link by a blogger or the occasional posting of copyrighted content. It's the world in which we live in which search engines are able to scoop up content free of charge on the internet and build their indexes out of it. And then on the other hand, I think we do need to look carefully at websites that may purport to be news websites, but that only consist of links to articles that other journalism organizations have put up online, and then sell ads around that.
Bruce, I'm sure as we move ahead, these issues are going to stir up a lot of interesting conversation. A lot of folks have plenty to disagree with, but there's some interesting points in there, and certainly the journalism you're talking about is important, and without that journalism, the information on the internet doesn't exist. So thanks very much for taking some time to spell it out for us.
Thanks very much.
All right, that's Bruce Brown. He's a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Baker Hostetler. Love to hear what you think about these ideas for a federal Journalism Recovery Act. Give us a shout at intheloopshow.net. And now, as promised, more North Korea-related music. I know you've been on pins and needles. This next one is pretty interesting, though. This guy named Bill Grueling listens to the show and follows us on Facebook. He responded to our call for North Korea parody ideas, not just with an idea, but with a full set of lyrics. And I said, Bill, if you're feeling gutsy, record those lyrics. Just use the microphone on your computer or whatever and send me the file. I can't promise anything, but could be a good experiment. I'll see what I can do with it. Well, Bill did just that. And so I took it into the studio, pulled out a little baritone ukulele, kind of just felt right to add a little color to it, and worked a little studio magic. And here we have it, Bill Grueling's North Korea song parody. You'll most likely recognize the tune.
I've got news under my ground. I've got news deep inside North Korea. So deep in Korea that they're really a part of me. I've got news under my ground. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist? 'Cause Obama, he knows damn well that I've got nukes under my ground. I'd sacrifice everything come what might for the sake of having them near, in spite of a warning voice comes in the night and repeats, repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you're gonna get down. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of Carpoo makes me stop before I astound. 'Cause I've got nukes under my ground. I've got nukes under my ground.
Okay, Bill Grueling of Minneapolis there on vocals and writing the lyrics, of course. Thanks a lot, Bill, for going out on a limb, taking a chance on us there. I thought that came out rather nice. It was about a year and a half ago I asked our In the Loop house band, The Smarts, to write a song about North Korea, and we still got that hanging around. Maybe just to round things out at the end of the show, we'll play that one for you. Sandon Totten is here, our producer. Sandon, thanks for coming by.
Howdy, Jeff.
And Sandon, I should say, suggested the Whitesnake song in the medley earlier in the show. That was great.
I sing that song to myself all the time.
I'm really surprised that, as you said, is one of your favorite songs. It doesn't mesh with your personality as I know it. But
you try it on karaoke and you'll get a different view on it. It works really well.
Well, you're back in here in the studio to revisit something we called the Scribbit Cast, I think, in our last podcast,
yep.
Which is this little widget we put on our website where people can, very simple, just ask us a question, tell us something they want us to look into.
And the other important part, of course, is that people can go and vote on the questions.
That's right.
And the most popular ones rise to the top. And today, we are taking on what has by far been, without a doubt, the most popular question ever on our Scribbit.
Ever.
In
the history of the...
All 3 months we've had
it. History of the Scribbit. Yes, drum roll.
The
please.
Question is, why are vegans and vegetarians so pushy about their diets?
Kind of a loaded question. That one comes with a point of view.
Right. So I thought the only fair thing to do here was ask a bunch of vegans and vegetarians. So I gathered together some vegans and vegetarians, you know, from our audience, and then some people I know. And, you know, I asked them the question straight out. Why are vegans and vegetarians so pushy? Here's what they had to say.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
I don't think we are pushy.
I mean, I know vegetarians and vegans that are pushy, but I don't feel I'm one of them, so it's hard for me to answer that question.
I think other people think we're pushy.
The last thing in the world I ever want to be is a preachy, pushy vegetarian.
I'm a little pushy because my family isn't necessarily vegetarian, and if I'm cooking, that's what they're getting.
Well, what I have found is that if a vegetarian or a vegan or a religious person or anybody is particularly pushy about their particular point of view, it's because they're really insecure about it.
I do occasionally say something to my son about chickens getting their beaks cut off when he's eating his chicken fries from Burger King, but I think anytime you do that, you're just really
off-putting to some people. I guess that's just not my personality.
If somebody asks me about it, I'm inclined to answer and tell them about why I feel the way I feel. But
I think people expect us to judge them, and so they get a little weird about it.
I do get a little bit pushy and defensive, especially when I get asked really annoying or stupid questions.
Why are you vegetarian? Don't you like meat? We're supposed to eat meat.
Oh, I have to have dairy or I won't get any calcium.
Vegetarians are sickly and weak.
The world comes off as being a very meat-eating world, and so vegans and vegetarians feel that, you know, they have to, like, fight really hard against it.
Why are they so pushy?
Oh, I think it's like any stereotype. It's based on something.
So many people have the picture of PETA in their mind, which PETA is pushy.
And it's easier to remember the guy who was a jerk screaming about tofu or, you know, meat is murder than, you know, your friend who just, you know, I don't eat a lot of meat.
So, I don't know. There probably is not one sort of one-size-fits-all reason why people are so pushy, but...
Everybody's got their issue, you know? No matter what it is that you care a lot about, you're going to be pushy about it. Whatever you're really passionate about, you're going to be pushy about. So
Well, that was really fun to listen to. They all sound like nice folks. Who all was in there, Sin?
Okay, that was, in order of appearance, Amanda Luker, Cindy Kernahan, Eric Zakis, Tom Weber, Sandra Evans, Nathaniel Salzman, Amanda Peterson, Michelle Lee, and Cassie Serena. Who's getting married this weekend, by the way?
Congratulations. So if you had to sum up the answer to the question, why are vegetarians and vegans so pushy with their diets?
I blame it on society.
It's everybody else's fault.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we've made great progress in crossing the ideological divide here today. Thanks for checking that out. Of course,
yep.
A question from our Scribbit, and you're gonna handle one more here that somebody had for us before we let you go.
This one was just a sort of simple statement. They said, "Simple, sustainable living at home."
Look into that, basically.
I guess.
Okay.
So I did. I asked, some of our listeners on Facebook and on Twitter for some tips, green tips.
Yep.
And
Twitter sound.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
I took their suggestions and I thought, you know, what would be useful is if we had little poems that people could remember to help them, you know, keep these green tips in their head.
Something figuratively, you just tuck in your pocket and keep with you so that you want to know.
Simply. Or scrawl on a bathroom wall. So I thought here I should make some limericks. So I've got a couple here I'm going to give to you, Jeff. These are going green limericks.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay. This first one is called Kitchen. When preparing a meal for gestation, use tap water in moderation. Get veggies from the land and the rest from a can, because neither needs refrigeration.
Oh, handy dandy.
Yep.
Sure. What's next?
This one's called Shopping. It might sound a bit cliched, but don't buy things that could be homemade. If you must shop, take note, remember your tote, and buy only stuff that's fair trade.
Hmm. Okay. Fair trade's better than the environment, I guess.
Well, yeah, I just needed something to rhyme with the rest of it.
Okay,
so.
Well, on the rhyming front, nicely done. Hit me again.
This one's called Climate Control. We draw curtains on hot sunny days so our houses won't heat up from the rays. We wear sweaters when it chills to save big on our bills. Lord knows we need it for our IRAs.
Cool.
And this is the last one here.
So round it out fourth time's a charm.
Here we go. This one's called Alternative Energy.
Yes.
You could always get power outside. Solar or wind could be tried.
Hmm.
But greenest of all comes when you stand tall and get power from self-righteous pride.
Okay. In a literal sense, what can you power with self-righteous pride?
Well,
I just have to ask.
As you may remember, I biked twice to work last week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a 20-mile round trip. And I would not have been able to get through those hills and, ride next to all those cars spewing out exhaust in my face if it were not for my confidence in the fact that I was better than everyone else on the road who was in a car. So, you know, I got pretty far in self-righteous pride.
That little engine inside your brain. Cool. Well, Sandon Totten, he's a poet and he knows it. I'm not, because that doesn't rhyme. If you change that little aphorism, it doesn't work, does it? But in any case, thanks very much for that, and you'll be keeping an eye on the Scribbit.
Yep, send more suggestions.
What other questions roll in. We'll see if we can keep this up. While we're in a poetry frame of mind, how about a listener poem, Sandon? Are you up for that?
Sure, let's go for it.
This is our buddy Craig Kenworthy out in Bozeman, Montana, who every now and then just hits us with his thoughts on the news of the week. And, of course, here's one on... What is this one on? Remind me.
The Supreme Court nomination.
The Supreme Court nomination of Sonia Sotomayor. Craig Kenworthy, take it away.
Republicans know voters gave Obama the ball, and the court as well. But they claim he's dribbling to his left too much with Sonia Sotomayor. A race to throw race into the picks mix. With 75 white males in the Senate waiting, and the White House wanting her to remix that statement about being wiser than all of them. So will the GOP be more afraid of one vote out of nine, or millions in 2010 who want to see the first Suprema Corte nominee in el banco ahora?
On the bench now, for those of you who don't speak Supreme Court-level Spanish, writer, poet, cowboy, I presume he's a cowboy, he's out there in my home state of Montana, Craig Kenworthy. You can learn more about him at craigkenworthy.com. Anybody can send us news poems. Just look for the link at intheloopshow.net. And by way of getting into our next segment here, our next guest, let me just put in a quick plug for not Facebook for a change. I think I've probably hit my quota for mentions of Facebook in this particular... Well, maybe not. Facebook there. Now I've hit my quota for mentions of Facebook in this particular episode of the podcast. But for what we call the Loop Network, which is it functions essentially like an email list, just a little bit more intimate way maybe for us to keep in touch with people who want to keep track of what we're doing with the show and what's coming up and what we're thinking about, what ideas we want to hear back from people on, that type of thing. If you're not in the network just yet, and well, you're listening to the podcast, so we've pulled you a certain ways into our bosom already. We would sure love to have you in the network, and you can sign up. Very simple. Just go to intheloopshow.net, our main webpage there, and look for the Join the Loop Network link on the right-hand side. It was a simple network sign-up, in fact, that led us to our next guest. I'm about to talk with someone named Alina Roberts, and she's just a kind of a great example of how this whole thing, the network, the loop concept, can and should and often does work to help us find fascinating people to talk to. So Alina signs up for our email list, and she's just kind of like, hey, you know, I like your show. I listen out in Oregon. You guys are awesome, blah, 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 the usual stuff. And by the way, I write this blog. It's called blindgal.com. And so Sandin clicks that blog link, and there's all this great stuff there. It's kind of like we have to get her on the show to talk about some of the things she's writing about. So Alina, from listener to guest, I guess, just like that, welcome to In the Loop.
Thank you.
You're with us from Corvallis, Oregon right now, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's get right into it. One of the things that you've been writing about recently in a couple of posts is driving.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever driven a car?
I drove a car when I was 15, and my dad let me drive in an abandoned parking lot.
And we should clarify for people, how long have you been blind?
I've had no real significant usable vision since I was 18, so about 10 years. And I had a little bit when I was 15, but not enough to drive a car.
What was driving like when you were 15? What do you remember about that?
I remember running over a beer bottle.
Nice work. Do you want to drive again?
I would like to drive again. I think it would be freeing. It would allow me to just go somewhere. And I don't really have that luxury. I can always walk out of the house and go somewhere random, but then I have to find my way back, which isn't nearly as fun.
So this is a roundabout way of getting into a tech story, I guess, that you blogged about the other day. Mm-hmm. Out in Virginia, at Virginia Tech, they're developing a car that blind people can drive.
Correct.
And not just a car that, you know, would drive a blind person around, but
right.
That a blind person can drive.
What
does that mean? How would you drive it?
So they want to make the car semi-autonomous. I believe it has some ability to correct your mistakes.
Okay, well, let's point out you're blind, so that would be a lot of mistakes.
Right.
Okay, so there must be more to it than that.
They are using sensors on the car to provide data to the person who's driving the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And they wear a set of headphones that can give them audio on their speed, their direction, if they need to turn. So I'm guessing they would be using GPS so that they can map out a route that mm-hmm. they need to take. Instead of a steering wheel, they're using a joystick. And I think that provides a little more control.
And this is very much just sort of in the testing stages, but
it's a
goal to have a car that blind people can drive. Does that feel realistic to you?
Sometimes I think yes, and sometimes I think no. I told my dad about it, and he said, so are they going to have a giant sign on the car that says blind driver? Because I don't know how I'd feel.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things that we can utilize because we don't have our vision. Our brain has mapped itself so that it can utilize other senses. Tactile and audio feedback might be enough for somebody to safely be able to drive a car.
Would you buy one? I mean, would you become one of the pioneers on the road with these
things? I'd happily test drive one. I'm wondering how the DMV is going to react, though. You know, how do we test somebody to get their driver's license? I think it's great that they want to go through this program of creating a car that we can drive, but then how do we get the government to actually allow us to do so?
Maybe a little bureaucracy between here and there.
Right.
I suppose. Another technological item that you wrote about the other day, a system they're working on to help blind people see using their tongue.
Correct.
Yeah, describe how that apparatus looks and what that would do.
So the technology is called the Brain Port. The way the system works is they attach a camera to a pair of sunglasses. The camera then takes images and sends those images into an electric pulse. So like a wire that's sitting inside of your mouth and will draw whatever the picture has been taken.
On your tongue?
On your tongue.
Draw it.
The people who have tested it say that it feels kind of like champagne bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to decipher what those champagne bubbles mean.
It sounds impossible. I can't imagine perceiving something like that on my tongue. But again, we're in this realm of heightened sensory perception in other areas.
I would imagine it's a lot like learning Braille, though. So my fingers have been taught to understand that certain bumps in certain places on a piece of paper mean something.
Is the tongue more sensitive than fingers?
I believe so.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. It might make sense.
One of their primary testers is Eric Weineminer, and he has scaled Mount Everest, and he's totally blind.
Using his tongue, we should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep going.
He's been able to play tic-tac-toe with his daughter. He's been able to play catch with a ball. So seeing the ball well enough to actually catch it.
Coming toward you through the images on your tongue. Wow.
Yeah.
As a blind person, does this feel practical to you? Something that you would, I guess, quite literally, I mean, strap on your head and use?
I think it could be pretty practical. I think we might get pretty strange looks. They don't really seem to think about fashion when it comes to tools for the blind. I had somebody come out for a new set of sunglasses that I'm getting, and most of their designs were less than fashionable.
Blocky,
I went with
and,
the more sporty look, which hopefully doesn't look too ridiculous.
Ray Charles kind of set the standard there, I guess, and people have followed that ever since.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something else that's been, I gather, a little bit of an annoyance to you lately, and you've been writing about it, the Amazon Kindle. It'll do text-to-speech, right, which
Correct.
Is important if you're blind. So what's wrong with the Kindle?
So it does text-to-speech, but the menu system is not text-to-speech. So if I were to utilize a Kindle, a sighted person would have to select whatever I'm reading.
Oh, that's annoying.
Yes.
So somebody has to set it up for you. Well, that's just stupid.
I know.
Why?
Because I guess they didn't think far enough ahead. The other frustration, though, is when they came out with the Kindle 2, with the text-to-speech feature enabled, the Authors Guild had a hissy fit, and they decided that text-to-speech available on an ebook reader would cut into their profits made by audiobooks, which is utterly ridiculous. I personally have to listen to synthesized voice every single time I use a computer. And if I had my choice, I'd listen to a professionally done audiobook any day. So they had their little hissy fit, and Amazon didn't want to, I think they just didn't want to deal with going to court or anything like that.
We're talking publishers, authors didn't like this idea.
Yes. Yeah. So they told the authors, all right, if you don't want the text-to-speech feature available on the Kindle, on your books, you have the right to shut it off. That was back, I believe, in March, and nothing had happened until last week when Random House decided to shut off the text-to-speech feature on all of their books. And that includes our President Barack Obama's books, Stephen King, and other very well-known authors, and they do it remotely. So if you've purchased the book and had intended, if you were dyslexic or had other types of learning disabilities that made it difficult for you to read, but this text-to-speech feature would make it easier for you, they can turn it off at any time.
Is there a kind of a blind lobby, I suppose, that's making noise about this?
Yes.
Other than you and your blog?
The National Federation for the Blind and the Reading Rights Coalition actually protested in front of the Authors Guild. We're hoping that we can convince Amazon that this is really unacceptable.
Jumping off from that, we asked on Facebook, our community on Facebook, if anybody had any questions, they maybe always didn't want to ask a blind person.
Sure.
And this one, somebody actually went to our webpage and recorded using our online voicemail that we have on the site.
My question for a blind person is this. When you close your eyes at night and you go to fall asleep, do you dream? And if you do you dream in color? Thanks so much for letting me ask this. I've always wondered.
Yes, I do dream. And yes, it is in color. Now, I had vision growing up, so that's a very important note to make. I don't know if people who have never seen actually do.
When you lay your head down to sleep, you see things.
Yes.
When you're awake, you don't.
Right.
Or maybe you do. I don't know.
Well, yeah.
Do you still see?
My brain doesn't process it.
Well, that's true. But do you still imagine images as you go through your day?
Sometimes. Sometimes I think I can see the table even if I don't really see it. So I know it's there.
Huh. You can see yourself running over that beer bottle.
Yeah, back on exactly.
Back when you were 15. One last question for you.
Okay.
This is from our friend Mark in Paris. He says when he sees people reading Braille, and you read Braille, of course, they seem to be reading with both hands at once.
Uh-huh.
And he wants to know, is that really possible? What's going on?
Well, I personally don't read with both hands. My braille is pretty minimal. I do know people, though, that do read with both of their hands, and I think that it allows them to read faster.
So it's like advanced braille.
Yeah.
Advanced braille reading.
Right.
I would think that would be almost like a superpower.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's like speed reading.
Right.
So would somebody be on kind of like two pages at once, or they would be...
No, usually their hands are right next to each other.
Okay. So one is moving sort of slightly ahead, and the other one
right.
is trailing. Well, Alina, this has been terrific, and thank you so much for simply letting us know that you were there and pointing us toward your blog.
Well, thank you for having me on.
That's Alina Roberts, and she was talking with us from Corvallis, Oregon, and she blogs at blindgal.com, something she calls Perspectives from a Blind Point of View. Well, we have reached the end, or very nearly the end, of this fair episode of the podcast. 46 minutes, says the little clock on my computer here, which, boy, time sure does fly when you're making a podcast. We're produced by Sandin Totten and me. My name is Jeff Horwich, of course, and I thought before we end, we might close it out while we're already on this kick with the North Korea music, with a little flashback to 2.5 years ago, I think it was. We were doing a live In the Loop show in the forum. The topic was diplomacy, something about diplomacy, and I had asked the band, the Smarts, if they would write us a song about North Korea. Which I think was perhaps their most challenging assignment from me to date. And they did a terrific job with it. And it's a song that actually has real staying power. I actually think this recording from the live show it's just kind of classic live In the Loop. It's just, you know, the microphones are maybe a little bit off and the band maybe misses a word here or there, but it's just got that sort of energy, that raw feeling that we got when we were doing those shows. And it's just a good song. And certainly fits with what we've been talking about today. So just a quick credit for the band: Joe Weissman on bass and vocals, Jimmy Kennedy on keys and vocals every now and then as well, Morris Engel on drums, and I think I sat in on this one on quite literally a little saxophone, my little curved soprano. The Smarts are online at thesmartsband.com, where, in fact, there's tons of In the Loop music up for download and listening, if you like. So check that out. Here we are, The Smarts... A song about North Korea and perhaps relationships. It's a dual-use song called Irreconcilable.
You won't talk when we're alone. Got your friends, I'm on my own. Lately seems the more I do, less I can get through to you. Make you see things from my view. I could crawl back in my shell, or I could blow it all to hell. Got one card, but play it well. Sorry if it feels like hard. To be, get you just to notice me, can't be taken seriously, spare me your diplomacy, meet me in my DMZ, just the two of us for coffee. Well, it's my way, or it's your way. Isolated I become.
Fly, I'm crazy or I'm dumb.
I may be the one the world's against.
The one who's working on a fence.